Please consider tuning out and revisiting CITR after this program.
Are you sitting comfortably? Then we'll begin.
Again there, friends in Whitecaps land, you're listening to There's Still Time, the AFTN soccer show on CITR Radio 101.9 FM, broadcasting from the unceded Musqueam Territory at the University of British Columbia. I'm Michael McCall.
I'm Steve Pander.
I'm Zach Meisenheimer.
This is our February the 12th show, and if you're listening to it on the podcast, it's episode 176. And it's been a very busy week for the Whitecaps, both on and off the pitch. MLS Commissioner Don Garber was in town. We'll talk about that a little bit later on in the show. New Whitecaps kit was launched to wonderful reception. No, wait. What's the opposite of wonderful?
I don't know. I'm not sure.
I tweeted out that it was released to a mixed reaction.
I think that's really
And I was told
sugarcoating it.
It's the new Rain City kit, the rain kit, the triangle kit, the pyjama kit, the pizza triangle kit. Lots of different names for it. I think I'll go with the crappiest kit they've ever released in their MLS history.
That's sugarcoating it.
That takes some doing as well. I mean, Zach, you were there at the town hall on Monday. What did you make of it when you saw its release, and what was the reaction like in the room?
Well, I don't think people were too surprised based on the teasers and the build-ups and the... in the room, I think people were like, what is this, a little bit? or is this for real? But
was there a hush or something? Or like a groan or anything like that? Or
in certain areas, I think there were some groans or some like...
But no booing or hissing or anything like that?
There was booing at other times. I'm not sure. I think there's booing at the kit. Yeah. See, you know, it's hard to boo when your players are walking out.
that's the players that
you appreciate are walking out.
Yeah, that's the thing. That's the whole timing of the marketing. Yeah. You get it at this right time.
For me, it raised the question, where does it fit into the
pantheon?
Yeah. Where does it fit into the Whitecaps arc of MLS kits? I think you said there was eight altogether.
I'm pretty sure there's four white. Yeah, three,
four white,
three
COA,
bluish.
And a third kit.
I think it's number 8 with a rocket.
it's possibly even number 9 from the top 8 kits, as far as I'm looking at it. If you were to rank then your three favourite Whitecaps kits from the MLS era, what would you go for, Zach?
Strangely enough, for me, there's only two, really.
Oh, is there?
Yeah, the original.
So everything tied for third.
Yeah, no, not even. For me, probably the one that stands out the most is the original blue, or secondary kit. And then for me, I'd say the Arbutus brown was one I appreciated. I liked the color and had a hoop, or a pseudo hoop on the front, which was nice. I think that the others. Haven't been great, but I don't think they've been like as even this one. I don't necessarily think it's like horrible as some people maybe feel. I think it's
I personally think it's utterly lazy, this kit.
Well, it is a little bit awkward as people have been releasing pictures of Adidas tops with the exact same thing on it. So yeah, it feels less original than it is, but it is also maybe original in the sense of being a football kit.
Yeah.
But maybe that's because it's so strange.
It is different. I will give them credit for that.
Different is not good sometimes.
But here's the thing. People, there's, whether it's a vocal minority or vocal majority, a lot of people would like to see a proper hoop kit, right?
Yeah.
You know, if Jay Duke was here, he would say, give me my hoop, you know? And so the thing is for me, and they're probably waiting for like an anniversary or maybe 2019 for the, the anniversary.
That's, for me, 40-year anniversary of the Soccer Bowl, 2019, that's when you're going to get your retro kit.
So here's the thing, though. And this is one of the things that I think people in modern sports, especially in North America, don't understand. Comes down to how I view what a football club is, and but people have power. You have power. If you do not like this kit, if you do not think it's good,
don't buy it.
Don't buy it.
Yeah.
Send the message to the people who are making these decisions in the only language they speak, which is financially. Well, so don't like it, don't buy it. I appreciate the idea behind having an integral campaign like they have. Like this, I'm not a fan of the rain thing, but at least it's like something that they're kind of like, it's shaping everything they're doing, their imagery. Like I appreciate that at least. But with that Sea to Sky, like we wore it half the games last year.
Yeah.
And so it's not home or away. It's all about selling the new kit. It's all about dollars and cents.
Yeah, yeah. So you were talking about appreciating the kit, the previous kits. And the thing is with me is I've only bought, talking back about going against the top three, I've only bought three kits since the, and that was the initial white one, because it was the initial one, the initial blue one, which I think is the best one out of the three, out of all of them, sorry. And then I bought the Arbutus brown one because it was something different. After that, I have never really liked their kits. I've never hated them, but I never liked them. But this kit that just came out this year, because I just find it, like I said, being so lazy, they just wanted to, and like you said, it's showing up on other Adidas stuff, that I've appreciated the other kits even more now. And they actually don't look as bad as they did when they first came out. I never hated them, but I never really loved them to buy.
I've never liked any of the home kits that they've brought out at all since 2011. For me, my top three, the current away strip, I love. Sea to Sky, love the colour scheme off it. I know you're not a fan, Zach, you're shaking your head here, but for me, that's my favourite. Second favourite would be the very first away kit, 2011, gorgeous blue colour that I've got upstairs. And then if I was pushed to pick a third, it would be the Arbutus brown, just because it was different and it went nice. It was something a little bit different. Being over in the UK the last couple of weeks as well, it was interesting. I was at a Newport County game. And for the game that I was at, they wore their away kit at a home match because they were doing a special promotion reduced in the club shop. And they had to get permission to use one of the few allotted times they're allowed to wear their away kit at home. So that's what they applied it for. And it has to be for a special reason, so like a promotion you're doing or to commemorate something. And that's how it should be here. Your home kit's worn at home, your away kit's worn away from home. Unless there's going to be some kind of weird colour clash away from home, in which case you can wear your home kit.
Yeah, to me, it's not. There shouldn't be home. It's not home and away. It's your primary kit, and you only wear your secondary kit when you.
It's a colour clash.
Kind of beat this to death, really. So the last thing I want to talk about strips is, now you're obviously involved with Curver Collective, one of the supporters groups. Something which has interested me is so many clubs across the world, they get fans to either design the kits or to vote on what ones they want, and they go with the fan choice. Has there ever been any discussions with the Whitecaps front office that the fans will have a say in what the kit selection is going to be?
Michael, you're asking if our front office would want to give up control of something?
Yeah. Naively, perhaps.
Not to my knowledge, but maybe in the early days of the MLS era, they might have looked at engaging. But, like, again, I can understand why they wouldn't, right? Because you're... because the timeline of things and keeping things
quiet. Everyone's going to go for the hoop.
And keeping it quiet and everyone going for the hoop. And because you do want to build, again, whether you love it or hate it, at least they've kind of gone all in and with an imagery that they're using for everything.
Yeah, I mean, there's a whole marketing campaign.
Yeah. One other comment about this motif that they've gone with that is lots of people have, again, also spoken about is, they're highlighting an element, like, it's integrated. I love that it's integrated. Like, it's something that is very Vancouver. How many people appreciate or love or are passionate that it rains a lot here?
Yeah.
You know, like, why would you highlight something that a lot of people see as a negative or an annoyance or a frustration?
Plus, they've said that, because we don't hide from the rain, says the team that plays under a roof. Let's leave it on that thought. So enough of the off-field talk. Let's get back to the on-field chat. And the pre-season is still in full force. We're recording this episode before the game on Sunday. We've had to do that because Zach's heading down to Portland for the pre-season friendly against Real Salt Lake. So the Whitecaps kicked off the Rose City Invitational Tournament in Portland on Thursday night. 1-1 draw with newcomers Minnesota United. It was a 1-1 draw. Minnesota took the lead. Fantastic headed goal by Eric Hurtado, unfortunately in his own net. Whitecaps went up the field, laser from the forgotten man. Well, I just think he'd actually forgotten how to attack. Russell Tybert made it 1-1. It was a little bit harsh on the Whitecaps, I felt, because I think they were the slightly better team. Can't argue too much with it being a draw, but the one thing that stood out was it was definitely stronger opposition than the 3-under-23 sides that the Whitecaps faced in Wales. And although there were some positives to take from the game, and it's pre-season, so you can't really read too much into it, but it wasn't the best performance. A good workout, Carl Robinson described it at, but I was disappointed.
Well, the weather cooperated, right? They got they got their rain,
yeah.
So they must have been happy about that. Yeah, I think in pre-season, I think you want there to be a progression in terms of the intensity of your opponents. So I don't mind the fact that we went from these U23 sides into playing, you know, a more tougher, stern,
experienced
side. So I know.
I was excited at the under-23 games, probably because I was on vacation. You just get caught up with this sheep, there's rolling hills, there's Welsh cakes, there's beer a breath. You get caught up with it. Whitecaps score 8 goals over 2 games and keep 2 clean sheets. You get caught up with that. Then you kind of see them against MLS opposition and you're like, ugh. The defence is still looking good. They were pretty much untested. I mean, apart from Eric Hurtado's moment of madness, which I know you guys
he was trying to clear it over the thing.
I mean, going back to last year, you could say, sure, it's an individual error or an individual misplay. That's fine. That happens. You want it to happen now in the preseason,
That aside, the defence looked pretty solid for the whole night. Kendall Waston made his start. We also saw on Thursday night the first appearance in a Whitecaps shirt of new attacker, midfielder, number 10. However he's going to fit into the mix, it's going to be as a number 10. Jordi Reyna. The Peruvian signed from Austrian club Salzburg. He really looked the part to me. I mean, he came on, it was a cameo appearance. He didn't really have much time on the pitch, but had a couple of nice moves. He kind of closed the ball down well, nice turns, not afraid to have a shot, kind of made the offence tick, and that was exciting. I mean, the prospect of having him in the middle, with Davies out right, Manny out left, Bola when he's fit out right as well, very exciting. All that's missing, of course, is this elusive number 9 striker.
Reyna could be our diminutive little talisman. And
I mean, he looked great. It's very, very, very early days to really kind of gauge what impact he's going to have. But he looked good. I mean, it was noticeable during the game. And then when you watch the Portland RSL game afterwards and the 6 goals in that, kind of the lack of real attacking threat in the team initially is concerning. There was a moment in the second half when Giles Barnes made a great run, went out wide, did everything right, put the perfect ball across goal right in the middle, and it was right where a number 9, which ironically Barnes was wearing, but that's where a number 9 would have been there just to tap it in. So we know the DP's coming. We know he would have scored that. So technically, I feel that was a goal, and we won 2-1. That's Robo's twisting.
Maybe then we do that for the whole season if the DP doesn't come.
Yeah,
fantasy points.
We are fantasy winners of the supporter shield, but I mean it was very obvious that's the piece that's missing. So I think the team that we're going to see against Portland on Wednesday is pretty much going to be the team that starts. the Champions League game against New York. And it should have some changes from that game against Minnesota. I think we're going to see Shane and Williams as the right back. Jake Nowinski's done well, but now that Williams has shaken off his injury and he seems to be coming back.
If he's 100%, you're not going to put a rookie in there at the first game.
Although Jake, I think, has performed admirably.
Yeah, I mean, he's done really well, rewarded with his contract, And then it's whether we get our DP number 9 striker in time for this game against New York. If we do, he's going to be playing up front. If not, we're probably going to have maybe Jordi Reyna up front, Nico Mesquita in the middle. The big question, I guess, is if you do that, you're probably going to have Kikuta on the left and you'll have Alfonso on the right. Yeah. Kikuta has been playing in the middle and I still hate it. I just think he's neutered and he's not at his best there.
No, yeah, but the Toronto game, he did play well in there. Yes, I think it depends on the opponents he plays. If it's depending on how the defense is set up, he can thrive in that position. Or, like you said, I agree with you, he could get lost in that position as well. So I think they have to be careful when they play him as number 10.
But I think in Toronto, I think he was more in the middle as up top. But to me, there's a difference between.
Yeah,
him playing with two strikers
or
him playing in those three. That's, to me, a drastic difference.
Yeah, it's true.
You also have the question that if the left wing spot is up for grabs, Marcel de Jong did really well in Wales.
Yeah.
As we talked about, the opposition maybe was not fantastic. Christian Teixeira, he did well in the last game in Wales in the win against Bristol City. Disappointed me against Minnesota. A lot of comments I saw about him about being lazy. He continues to frustrate me because he has the ability.
Oh, 100%.
He had a great free kick last night that just went inches by in the first half. But he's just... I don't know, he's not bringing it. It's like he doesn't feel under pressure to be at his best.
The thing is when he first came, we saw the highlights. I remember us watching the highlights and we both remarked that he was going into the box. He was like, just like a, you know, little bull in a china shop, was just going in the box, attacking and everything like that. He did it initially when he came here, and then he got like complacent for some reason. And I think maybe you're right. He's not feeling pressure signing that contract.
I think there's healthy competition for places on that left side, especially if Kakuta is going to play in the middle or up top or whatever. So I think. I know this is not everything, but like this offseason, like Marcel de Jong worked hard. And he let people know via his social media he was working hard to be ready for the season. He had the Canadian camp to get ready for, which made him more ready for our preseason. So he came into our preseason like ready for it. Like a lot, I know this is not the be all and the end all, but if you look at the players' social media in the offseason, a lot of them it was like the sun they got in, the time they were with their family, whatever.
Bleaching hair.
Yeah. Marcel had he was in the gym nonstop, right? And then I think he was, you know, working early, even when he was in Vancouver and not away, working crazy hard to get ready for the season. So I hope that pays off for him and for us. But I think there's a good battle to be had over there. I think also it was nice to see this preseason him playing where he belongs, which is further up the field than not.
And
left back.
It's the best that I've seen De Jong as a whitecap, and I was impressed by him. Again, opposition, you can look at all that, but he impressed me. And, there's definitely competition for a number of spots. And one thing which was revealed this week as well is it looks like the roster size is going to be increased again. It was 28. It's going to be 30 with the potential of having 31 if you loan a player to your USL team. The exciting thing for me is competitive football is now just 11 days away. But as we said, it wasn't just on the field that was a busy time in Whitecaps land this week. And we're going to come to that next, after these important messages.
The Thunderbirds just keep flying. Join us this Saturday as CITR Sports brings you UBC Basketball. The unstoppable Thunderbirds men and women, led by superstars Madison Penn and Connor Morgan, will look to claw through UNBC in their final homestand before the playoffs. Tip off at 5 p.m. this Saturday from War Memorial Gym, only on CITR 101.9 FM.
Crimes and Treasons Radio, this is Riff Raff. Every Tuesday from 9 to 11 p.m. on 101.9 FM.
Yes, yes, you are now rocking with the best. 101.9 CITR Radio. Crimes and Treasons, this is your boy Just Blaze. Right now you're rocking with Jules Andre Brown, Rolly Bells, Jamal Steels, and Horsepower. You know what it is, right?
Yo, it's I Am Sue, man. I want to shout out Crimes and Treasons Radio, man. CITR 101.9, man. Turn up, turn up, turn up.
Welcome back. You're listening to the AFTN Soccer Show on CITR Radio, 101.9 FM, broadcasting from the unceded Musqueam Territory at the University of British Columbia. So as we mentioned, it's been a very busy week here in Vancouver. Off the pitch, as well as on it, Monday saw MLS Commissioner Don Garber in town. He had a media meeting in the morning, which I was at. No hissing at that, though.
No. Well, obviously not.
No. But no, he had a meeting with the media in the morning, did some charity stuff. He also met with Whitecaps technical staff. The Whitecaps had a meeting on Monday just for all their technical staff across the country, all the academies, everything like that. They brought them into Vancouver so that everyone's kind of on the same hymn sheet. And then Garber had a town hall meeting at the Vogue on Monday night. Alongside Jeff Mallett, Bobby Leonarduzzi was there, Carl Robinson. I feel I'm missing someone.
Stephen Nash.
Oh, yeah, Steve Nash. So the meeting that the media had with Garber on Monday, it was good, it was informative. You're never going to get any earth-shattering things out of it. Although he did reveal that teams are going to be subsidised for having Canadian designated players. And he said, as we announced, but everyone's looking at each other going, I've never heard this in my life. But there was a number of good things. And
hashtag transparency.
Oh, yeah. I mean, transparency was brought up a lot. And when you've got the commissioner in town, you want to kind of raise some of the big hot talking points in the league. So I kind of went on a bit about referees with him. I think so much so that by the time, as you'll hear this, I asked the third question, his response was, wow. So yeah, I mean, MLS refereeing, it's not the best. He disagrees, he would. We'll talk about that in a sec. Let's hear now from Don Garber, and just the questions I put to him on Monday, just about the state of MLS refereeing, whether Disco undermines the referees, the new video assistant referees that's getting brought in, and pro, just everything about it. So let's hear now from MLS Commish, Don Garber. I'm pretty sure one of the things you're going to get asked about tonight is the standard of refereeing. Last season it just seemed to take a step back again. And even watching the CONCACAF games, the difference between the referees, the CONCACAF games, the games just were allowed to flow. Is it the league that's sending the message to the referees that you want to kind of sanitise the game? Because it feels like you're almost wanting to take tackling out of it.
No, it's not the league. You know, Pro, which you're probably familiar with, is an entity that's jointly managed by the CSA and the U.S. Soccer Federation. It's based in the MLS League office and has the same kind of structure that the PGMOL has with the Premier League. But at no time has an MLS executive ever sat down with Peter Walton and say, this is how we want you to officiate a game. I mean, they are an independent body. We provide the vast majority of the funding so that we could have more full-time professional referees, that they're getting properly trained, they're getting properly assessed, that they have the right technology. But there is no, and I don't think there is in any league, some edict that comes down from the league to tell them how they should be refereeing the games. So the answer to that is no.
Were you happy with the standard refereeing last
year? I think it's a lot better than most people give us credit for. When I look at Premier League games and I watch them like you guys do, I see the same level of challenges with the game as exist in our league or exist in Liga MX. It's the nature of the sport. And I think we're unfairly criticized for the standard of refereeing in our league. And I'm not quite sure why that is. When we look at how our referees are assessed and the level of what we call key match, or the number of key match indicators, the decisions that they're making over the last couple of years have been better and better, and yet our fans think that refereeing has gotten worse and worse. But then I'll travel over to England, or I'll travel over to Spain, and I hear the same thing. So I think it's the nature of the sport. I think globally it's why FIFA and IFAB and many of the top leagues have gotten behind video assisting the whole VAR program, because I think we're going to provide technology and hopefully give the referee the tools to hopefully take away some of the decisions that they do make that are incorrect, because that happens in all leagues. You know, I'll just give you a man on the street story. The other day, I was meeting with a top English referee, and he was talking about how he refereed a World Cup final. And he missed a key call in that final, and he said, "Hey, I made the wrong call. You know, if I would go back today, I'd probably make a different decision. But that's the game, and that was the World Cup final." And I think he's a very well-respected referee that most people think is one of the top referees in the world. So I get frustrated with that, the level of criticism. But you know, hopefully VAR or VAR addresses some of that. Not sure that it will.
Last thing for me on that then, with disco, it's hard not to feel it kind of undermines the referees during the game a little bit. And then on Monday you've got Soundborg on the website highlighting every single missed call and saying that should be a red. Then when it comes down to the kind of the disco panel decisions, there does seem to be an element of inconsistency there. There was a number of high profile players that maybe didn't get the suspension, whereas players like, say, Vancouver were picking up suspensions left, right, and centre.
Oh, man. Well, that could not be further from the truth. As the guy that ultimately has to weigh in on the appeals that take place and the numbers of appeals by players have gone down dramatically, and I think that's an example of the process is working. You know, in the early days of the whole discipline committee process, you know, I think I was reviewing, you know, and had an appeal almost every week. I think I had three last year. And one or two of them, I think we overturned the decision of the discipline committee. You know, we would lose all credibility if we were making decisions that, and I said we, if the discipline committee was making decisions that were either protecting or unduly putting scrutiny on any particular player. So it would be interesting to put those all up in a screen and take a look at them, because I think if you were, I think you'd see that they are very consistent in their view. Remember, that's got players on it. It's got a union representative on it. It's got a number of league technical people on it. And they have to rule unanimously in order to enact any discipline. So five guys have to all come together and see the play the same way, which might be different than the official saw. So let me get to the whether it is providing, sort of second-guessing the official. You know, I think the discipline process is the time that the league and the union can come together and govern a bit the way the game is played. So if in the preseason our players and our coaches and our technical staff, the league office, are saying, you know, we've had a number of reckless tackles that have caused career-ending injuries, and for whatever reason the official was out of position or the official was missing those calls, we want to send a message to our players, not the league office. This is coming as much from a partnership with our union. We want to send a message that, you know, we want our players to be safe and we want them on the field, so that the discipline committee is going to be reviewing those kinds of tackles. That's post, you know, play. That's not during. They're not sending that message to the referee. There was a time several years ago where there were issues with head injuries, and there were a number of elbows to the head. And I think in one year, I don't know the exact statistic, but an unusual number of injuries during play with reckless elbows. And the discipline committee came together and said, we'd like to not see that happen. And they sent a message out that said, you know, you're going to have to be more careful in how you go about clearing yourself for a head ball, for an example, while heading the ball. And we reduced injuries. So I think that's actually a positive thing. Believe it or not, other leagues have looked at our discipline committee and have thought about putting that process in place, because I think it is a way to protect your players. One thing that you'll notice interesting, I don't think I've ever mentioned this before, when we do an appeal, we remind the players' union that they're representing both the player who has been disciplined and the player who might have been injured. Because there are two players involved, not just the player that's been suspended. And the debate that goes on in that appeal generally is reflecting whether or not that player did something that was violent in nature. And I don't think I've ever had a player that said, you know, I really intended to do that. But in almost every case, they say, hey, I didn't mean it, but, you know, I'm really sorry that that guy, you know, got injured on that play. So it's an interesting, the whole discipline process is an interesting thing. I think you'd probably say, wouldn't it be fun to have more transparency on it?
Why not make the names public of who's on discipline?
You know, I actually think it is to protect them, you know, for all the reasons that you could imagine. I mean, I think it is really positive that there's a lot of social energy around this stuff, far more so than ever before. There is more interest in transparency. There's more hot stove stuff going on, both with the media and fans. That moves the league in a certain direction. But as it relates to ensuring that those five people can do their job and do it without having any undue pressure, I think that's important. You know, they are, and I don't think, again, they get enough credit for it, they review every single game. They review every single play, and they've got to go through that to ensure that they're getting it right in a unanimous way. It's a lot of work. Nobody's paid for it. So.
So Don Garber there talking about a whole load of things about MLS refereeing. For me, it's terrible. And, I mean, it was raised at the town hall meeting as well. He got a hard time there about it. MLS refereeing is not up to the standards required to have this league as one of the top leagues in the world, which Garber so dearly seeks. Although he did also say in the meeting as well, when he was pushed on about having the best league in the world by, say, 2022... he said he might push that back to 2026 now. But, I mean, just some quick thoughts on MLS refs.
Yeah, I don't have a problem with him defending it, but he should be saying it's like top quality or something in the world. There are so many holes that you expect. Just like the quality of play, the quality of refereeing has to improve. And I would rather have him say, we're trying to educate our referees, trying to get new people in and everything like that. I'd rather hear him say something, stuff like that, instead of, I know he can't rip the referees, but remember, the referees are a separate organization too. So if he wants to rip them, he can rip them. They're not going to do anything to him.
I mean, he was keen to point out that they're independent. He's keen to point out that
no one connects with them.
Yeah, I mean, they're independent, but they do work out of the league office. Yeah. He was also keen to point out that there's no edict from the league that we want to clamp down on this, we want to clamp down on that.
Isn't that the exact opposite of what was reported last year?
Yeah.
That's not possible, because where else are these edicts coming from?
Well, he says that Pro meet with the players' union, and the players' union raised concerns that they have about, oh, this tackles injury our kind of guys. There's lots of elbows, there's head knocks. We want you to clamp down on this, this, and this. Which, as you heard there, he said that. But then the interesting thing is, when all the decisions were happening at the start of last season, so many players were speaking out about it, and they didn't seem to know that all these decisions had been agreed with the players' union.
Yeah.
So somewhere along the line, there's either miscommunication or worse. But he's adamant that the league do not tell referees what to do. Maybe they should. I do feel the game is getting sanitised. And you watch Champions League games, and the game flows.
Yeah.
And it's sensible refereeing.
At this point, I don't know how much you can rely on the refereeing being top. I think at this point, you might have to set your team up to fit whatever the referees are going to do. So maybe, I know they want to be a physical team and everything. Maybe you can't do that anymore in MLS. Maybe you're going to have to be.
Well, Kendall Waston can't.
Yeah, because he's. And the problem is because he's getting so many yellow cards here and there that maybe it's affecting his game and he doesn't want to play like that. And that's the way he's supposed to play.
He has dyed his hair for this season, yes. I think, so that people don't recognize him.
Yeah, that'll help for sure.
I think he's sorted. He's golden with that.
Yeah.
The other big thing that's been introduced is VAR, video assistant referees. And it's a system that is in place at the moment during the pre-season tournaments. I think it's something like 15 of the 22 MLS teams are going to be subject to this in the pre-season. Then it's going to run during the MLS season, kind of, not during games, kind of like offline, up until the All-Star game, where they're going to kind of review it and see how things are with it. So it was in force at the Portland Invitational Tournament on Thursday. Everyone thinks it was first used in the RSL Portland game, but it was actually first used in the Whitecaps Minnesota game beforehand.
But there's nothing to review.
No, you see, people might think there was nothing to review, but they actually reviewed Eric Hurtado's own goal because even the referee wanted to know what the hell he was doing. But no, officially, it was used for the first time. Portland, RSL, Diego Chara got a red card for an elbow to the head of RSL's Jura Movsisian.
It took about 3 minutes to review,
I mean,
right?
The first thing is, it was great because it was a correct decision. There was an elbow.
Flying elbow.
The referee missed it, despite it taking place right in front of
his face.
Not quite sure how he missed it.
It's clearly the elbow. You could see the elbow joint going into the side of the head.
Yeah. And the incident took place at the 37:54 mark. Chara was not shown the red card until the 43-minute mark.
So almost under 3 minutes.
2 minutes, 49 seconds from the incident taking place to the red card being shown. And what was even more baffling was it was 53 seconds before the referee, Soren Stoica, who'll be known to many Whitecaps fans as the guy that sent Carl Robinson off against New York last year, it was 53 seconds before he even called for the review. And at that time, the RSL guy's waiting to take the corner, which had transpired from the play. And he's asking the assistant referee, do you know what's happening? I don't know what's happening. And I'm not sure the linesman really knew what was happening. But obviously, Stoica got a message in his ear saying, you should actually review that. Because there's four things they can review. Red cards, mistaken identity, goals, and penalty kicks.
Well, the thing is, you're talking about the referee. I think it should be faster than 53 seconds for them to send the message from down there.
Totally.
That needs to be faster. They need to be within 10 seconds. They need to see a replay and send the message down to get them to review it.
Then it was a full 2 minutes from review to red card.
Yeah, and then that should be faster, too, because it was a clear red card, even in the replays. So they just need to... I don't have a problem with the review, but it has to be way faster than 3 minutes when it's not obvious.
Well,
if it's a goal where it's just over the line, that I can understand.
Well, then you've got your goal line technology as well, and your wristwatch, which is instantaneous, as we saw during the Women's World Cup. But it was just over a minute for Stoica to review it, and it was nearly another minute as he communicated to everyone. But the good thing about it was the correct decision was made in the end.
Yeah.
Now, I've always been a bit of a purist, a traditionalist, you might even want to say a Luddite. I don't like this technology change in the game.
You're not cock-a-hoop over it.
No, I'm not. I'm all for instant referees, video referees, if it's a really quick thing and it doesn't really delay the game by much. That was too long. It's going to get streamlined. I think that was just...
That's the initial
clearly
thing.
Not acceptable. Yeah. But I have completely changed my opinion on it. And I'm all for technology now helping in the game. The issue I always had in the past was it has to be consistent so that if you're seeing an MLS, the same thing can happen in, say, VMSL. Obviously, that's not going to happen. But there's been so many cock-ups in MLS that, for me, video refereeing and anything that can help them during the game, not undermine them afterwards like disco, it can only be good.
Howard Webb has been hired, as was noted earlier, that he's the head of this video reviewing system. And as long as Manchester United doesn't join MLS, we should have no problem at all with it. So I think it's all right. Now, one quick question to you. Do you guys would rather have the clock running at the time, or do you want it to stop clock?
You can't stop.
Okay. Because that kind of is going to be weird where if it's a lot of replays, they're going to have to do injury time, and they're going to have to do replays. Yeah. So that's going to be like 9 minutes to it.
You know, the biggest thing is might impact broadcast time.
Yeah, right? That's the issue. It's going to be a big problem.
But broadcast should be 2.5 hours at the minimum. Yeah. Anyways. But,
yeah. Well, there's no broadcast left in Vancouver anyway, so I think we're fine. Yeah. Got a few things still to cover in this week's show, and we're going to come to that after these messages.
Do you want to go to a party with me? No, the game's on. Oh, I almost forgot. I'll be right there.
We like sports and we don't care who knows. From shooting hoops to the Super Bowl.
Do you like sports and don't care who knows? Then CITR Sports needs you. If you like sports, are into radio, or generally just want to have a great time, then come join us. Email our sports coordinator at sports101@citr.ca to find out more, or come by the station in the new sub. See you soon.
Watch, because I'm the man.
In April of 2016, British Columbia declared a medical emergency for the accelerated incidences of preventable accidental deaths from overdose, a problem that has swept North America as the drug market is flooded with fentanyl.
This Tuesday, February 21st, join a coalition of impacted parties to march in downtown Vancouver to demand an end to this overdose epidemic. For more information, visit capud.ca or follow #LifeWon'tWaitFeb21 on Twitter.
Welcome back, and you're listening to the AFT and Soccer Show on CITR Radio 101.9 FM. Now we're going to come to my favourite section of the show. It's only the second week of it, but already it's my favourite section.
It's one of my favourites too now.
Yeah, and it was actually the part of our debut CITR show that got the best reaction from Twitter, from emails, direct messages, lots of people getting in touch, and it's our wavelength section. So for those that maybe missed the first show, wavelength is the part of our show where we're going to play a football-related tune by a proper band. So we're not just talking football chants, we're talking proper bands, proper music with a football theme. Before the break there, we were talking about referees with Don Garber. So I thought I'd get us a referee-themed tune for this week. And for that, there's no one better than Merseyside band Half Man, Half Biscuit. A band who's had many football-related songs over the years. We're going to feature them in many of our episodes to come, I'm pretty sure. And for this week's wavelength tune, we're going to go with a song called The Referee's Alphabet from the 2003 album Camel Laird Social Club. Now, that's kind of a piss take on the Buena Vista Social Club, which was kind of out at the time. And Camel Laird is actually a football club in Merseyside, Birkenhead, who currently play in the North West Counties Premier Division.
Impressive.
Yeah. So this is just a wonderful A to Z of refereeing from a referee's viewpoint. This is The Referee's Alphabet by Half Man, Half Biscuit.
The A is for my authority, which many players seem to question, thinking they're somehow going to make me change my mind. B is for babies, which a lot of managers cry like after a decision has not gone their way. C is for the continual criticism I receive from the touchline. Get back in your technical area. D is for the dunderheads who seem to think we have a conspiracy against their particular team. E is for the eerie silence which echoes around the ground when I've booked a home team's player and it's obvious to everyone that he deserved it. F is the farce into which most games would descend if we weren't there. The G is for the gnarled face of someone who's on £90,000 a week and reckoned he should have had a throw-in. H is for handball, which has to be intentional and very rarely is, if only people would study the rules more. I is for innocence, pleaded by many a doe-eyed defender after they've just scythed down that tricky winger. J is for jiu-jitsu, which I quite intend to display given a dark alley and some of the narky blurts I've encountered. The K is for the kissing of the badge. How ridiculous that looks 6 months later when they're at another club. L is for lip reading, of which you don't have to be an expert to see how odious some people are. M is for the mistakes we sometimes make. Surely a bit of controversy is part of the game's appeal. The N is for the numbskull who during the Boxing Day game asks me what else I got for Christmas besides my whistle. An afternoon with your wife, mate. The O is for offside, which many forwards tell me they simply could not have been. The P is for the penalty shootouts. Great drama and no pressure on me. Q is the quiet word which I sometimes need to have with some of the more fiery participants. I usually choose the word pleat. R is for running backwards, a difficult skill which the pundits never seem to appreciate. S is for the suggestion that I should have shown a card of some sort to a player who's just been awarded a free kick. Sorry, I got all that wrong. The S again. Okay, the S. The S is the suggestion that I should show a card to an opponent by a player who has been awarded a free kick. He himself is more in danger of getting one for that. T is for the 21-man brawl, which is basically an embarrassing scene of pushing and shoving. U is for the umpire, which I sometimes wish I'd been instead. You never hear a cricket crowd chanting, "Who's the bastard in the hat?" The V is for vitriol, vilification, vendetta, and volley of verbal abuse. Some good bird noises there, boy. W is for Walter Pigeon, who's Mr. Griffiths in How Green Was My Valley I may have started to sound like during this song. Where was the light I thought to see in your eye? He says that to a young Hugh played by Roddy McDowell. The X. The X represents the sarcastic kiss planted on my forehead by a swarthy Portuguese centre-half whom I just dismissed. The Y is for Yate, the kind of town that referees come from. And the Z. Well, the Z could be for Zidane, Zico, Zola, Zubi Zaretta, Zoff, even Zondervan. But is in fact for the zest with which we approach our work. Without this zest for the game, we wouldn't become refs. And without refs, well, zero. See also Zatepe, Zeus, and Zeal Monochorum. Have a caravan there. Static. Naturally.
Half Man, Half Biscuit there with the referee's alphabet from their 2003 album, Camel Laird Social Club. So just before we kind of wrap up this episode of this show, as we mentioned, there was the town hall meeting at the Vogue on Monday night. Everyone was there. And the snow and everything like that. But I mean, Zach, you made it there. What was your kind of overlasting impression of how it went down, kind of the reaction of the fans, the topics that were raised and the answers that were given?
Yeah, I've never gone to one of those events before, and I usually wouldn't go. I went just because I wanted to hear Garber. I wanted to hear what they were going to say. Yeah. It was fine. Like, it was nothing was shocking. Both in the questions and in the answers.
A lot of vanilla questions. Was it picked out, the questions? Or?
No, that was, to be honest, that was one of the most surprising things. They actually had open mic.
Okay. Yeah.
But it wasn't like unlimited open mic. It wasn't like unlimited follow-ups. Or like there's some people who didn't get to ask their questions, which is understandable.
And there were some really strange questions in there, highlighting some of them.
Well, you know, it didn't end on a good question, I'll say that. But
everybody comes to it from different points of view, so
So it would have been nicer if there could have been more follow up to some of those questions, right? Like, because some of the answers were given were kind of what you would expect, but they weren't necessarily the answers you'd want.
That's where you right? gotta. That's where you kind of come in with three people organized in a row, in a back to back to back. So they're all like, if asked the first person, asked the first question, second follow up, their follow up.
Yeah, but not everyone likes to speak in public. Or yeah, so I discovered. But but no, like you, yeah, it was an opportunity. I think in some ways. There were some good things about it, but there weren't enough hard hitting deep questions.
I thought it was a good thing for the Whitecaps to put on.
Yeah.
Don Garber had mentioned to us in the morning that he's going around
doing this kind of thing.
The country, like America and Canada, just now doing these town halls all over the place, and he says he enjoys it. He said he also enjoys doing the media ones, and he doesn't want the questions to be kind of like predetermined. He likes the spontaneity of it. And for all the criticism we can maybe give him and the league and stuff like that, I do admire that he does things that a lot of league commissioners and other sports, even in football, would not go and do.
No.
And is sit down with his most kind of critical audience and take questions. And there was a couple of tough ones for him. He didn't get as tough a ride as I actually expected him to.
Mm-hmm.
Neither did Jeff Marlett,
who I
thought was an excellent speaker.
Yeah, so, I don't know about that. But for me, it was, I mean, personally, I asked the question of Garber, but my more pointed question would have been for Marlett, or even Steve Nash. I think the most disappointing thing is, I wonder if Jeff Marlett was listening to when Robbo and Bobby were on stage, because Bobby kind of reiterated something he hasn't fully reiterated in a while, was that the model of what we're doing is based on quote unquote Ajax and Lyon.
Yeah.
Which was, you know, Jeff earlier in the few months ago with his piece with Weber was like, players coming in don't understand what it means to be a Whitecap. So I wonder if he was listening to that and he understands to be a Whitecap is to follow quote unquote an Ajax or Lyon model. Which, as supporters, I think is frustrating. And to me, the follow up to that, which wasn't asked, is if those are our models, how are we doing in those models? And maybe I'll write something. Maybe I'll write something for AFTN to kind of explore that further. But they keep on talking. Indy Mallett talked about this. They keep on talking like, oh, we're this blue chip startup company, blah blah blah. No, like you can't out of one side of your mouth say we're this great, we have this great history and this great, we've been around for so long in different iterations and whatever, but we're also this, like we're just this, we're the new puppy, we're you know whatever. You can't speak out of both sides of your mouth. Yeah. They do that all the time, and they're only talking that way because we have not performed, because we've not lived up to our potential. And that's what I think supporters are most disappointed about.
Yes.
See, for me, we have an interesting fan base here. And it's going to be the same every MLS club throughout North America. Every NASL and USL club probably as well. You've got the hardcore supporters that live and breathe for the club.
And pay attention to the ongoing, whatever's going on.
Are on the Twitter, forums. On the forums, on Facebook. Yeah. And there's a lot of hostility there. And I do wonder, when you have a meeting like this town hall, where it is more mellow, are we kind of too caught into this small group of malcontents? And the vast majority, they don't care. It's like, they just want
to go for the entertainment.
And it's like, as long as that is the majority, nothing's really, really going to change.
Which is unfortunate.
Yeah.
But eventually, maybe it can turn around, because there's another sports team, the top sports team in Vancouver right now, where almost everybody's hardcore. And they get criticism from everybody. And there's very few casual fans that are just looking for entertainment. So do the Vancouver Whitecaps eventually become to that point where they are going to have to pay attention to all this information?
Well, here's a question. Will they be able to get to that point? If they keep going the way they are?
Yeah. That'll depend on how big the league grows, too.
It's also the thing as well, it's like, the Whitecaps would probably like to be the number one team.
Oh, they'll never be the number one team.
But be careful what you ask for.
Yeah.
Because with that comes the extra scrutiny.
Yeah.
But that's the thing, though.
The extra scrutiny puts the pressure on the
even if there's a scrutiny, there's like, and this would have partly been one of my questions for them if I'd asked them, as not Garber, because I asked Garber about accountability on some issues. And I would ask them the same question. How are you guys being accountable on some of these areas where you say this is what we are and you're not that?
Yeah, and that's because it was. I mean, Garber revealed to the media in the morning he'd had a meeting with the Whitecaps owners, and I think it was Greg Carefoot that had said to him that he spends $6 million a year on youth development at the club. So then, who is accountable for that amount of money, which is a sizeable chunk, not producing quality, regular flow of players into the first
team? And how much of that is being inflated? Like, I'm assuming Gerford thinks he's being spending $6 million, but is he actually spending $6 million? Like,
well, he will be when you look at things like the under-18s have to travel to California constantly, yeah, and they're flying there.
How much of that is involved in the infrastructure?
I think, yeah, exactly. That's what I'm trying to say. Like, yeah, like it's a lot of stuff is, as we all know, gets cut.
But, and
sliced.
But ultimately, like that is a question. Yeah. One of the questions I would have asked of Mallet, or potentially of Bobby, is who is accountable for this?
Yeah.
Like, you can say, we want to be this club that produces great young players for our national team. But if that's what you say you're doing, what do you have to show for it?
Yeah, you have to have the results.
And it was nice to see. Going back to the top of the show, it was nice to see Russell score a goal.
Yeah.
I hope it's good for his confidence. I hope it gets some people laying off his back a little bit, because in the support culture, not just you, but there are some people who rag on him, I think, unnecessarily. But like, because he is probably the best thing our academy has produced. Yeah. We could do a whole hour on development alone. We have developed some players who are either dominant or very high quality at age level.
Yeah.
It's how do you make that transition?
And Caleb Clark, possibly one of the best examples.
Great example. So how do you help them make that transition? Okay. So, and not just on the field. It's more than just on the field, because we've heard a lot of people talk about the mental side of things, right? For some of our players who've tried to make that jump, and really rag on them. But what are we doing to, if we say this is how it is, what are we doing to make it the way we want it to be? And those are questions that need to be asked.
There's so many questions, and it's a shame to kind of have to wrap the show up on that. But, I mean, we will have a development special in one of our future shows. That is something we've got penciled in. Anyway, let's end that show on this note. Just before we go, if you want to just let everyone know where they can find you online. Zach?
Yeah, it's at Zachary AM on Twitter, and I'm a part of a movement called Curva Collective.
And you can find me at WhitecapsBeat on Twitter.
Thanks, Steve. I'm Michael McCall. You can find me on Twitter at AFTNCanada. Read all our stuff away from the numbers, AFTN.ca. I'm also the Whitecaps Beat reporter for MLSsoccer.com and the Western Conference reporter for USLsoccer.com. So check out my stuff on that. Hope you've enjoyed this episode of the AFTN Soccer Show. We'll be back next Sunday for more. Check out all our previous podcasts of previous shows on AFTN.ca. A lot of good stuff that we brought you from the pre-season trip to Wales. Don't want you to miss out on any of that. So until next time, as always, thanks for listening. Take care. And mon the Caps!
Going to your first match is an experience you never forget. The atmosphere of what's going on around the pitch looks beautiful, and you always look and go, wow, I'd love to play here one day. If you get the bug, it's going to stay with you for life.
Hempology 101.
is a student-run organization here to educate the public about the benefits of hemp and cannabis. Fast fact! Hemp is a renewable, sustainable source of food and fiber. Fast fact! Your body contains anandamide, which is part of the same family of substances as THC. To learn more, look us up on Facebook at www.facebook.com/groups/hempology101UBC or come to one of our great events. And don't forget, legalization through education. Can't make no money, give.